It's the California Wine Country Podcast with Steve Jackson and Dan Berger. We taste, we laugh, we learn.
California Wine Country, brought to you by Bottle Barn. Dan Berger is here, and this is going to be interesting. Our guest today is Tony Dunn, president of ConeTech. When I looked at it today, I thought, ConeTech, that can't be right. It's probably Conatech.
No, that sounds more. ConeTech is right.
ConeTech. It's out of Silicon Valley, I think. It's some. No, okay, it's ConeTech. And before we get into the particulars on this, and again, I find this fascinating. They're based in Santa Rosa. Let me just read this from the website, which is ConeTech.com. They are a pioneer of alcohol adjustment, alcohol reduction. Now, that's just fascinating. And it says, with 100% preservation of aroma and flavor. So, Tony, I can't imagine how this works. Let's start with why. I mean, how did this all come about? I mean,
well, it all began about 29, 30 years ago when I actually owned a winery at the time.
And here?
Having come into the industry from outside, and one of the first things I learned was that California alcohols were going sky high.
Yeah.
Partly it was a fashion thing, partly a climatic thing. But alcohols were sort of zooming into the 15% range. And winemakers were faced with the uncomfortable choice of picking their grapes early or selling an alcohol bomb.
Yeah.
And I felt that if one could do something about this without actually messing up the wine totally, it would be to the enormous benefit of the industry. And I cast around the world for technologies that might enable this to happen. And in the end, found a remarkable little company, engineering company in Australia, that had come up with an invention called the spinning cone column, which at that time had never crossed the Pacific Ocean. But I brought the very first one into the United States and offered it to the industry as a means of solving that particular problem. And what it absolutely does do is keep the promise that of alcohol removal, without any destruction or loss of aroma or flavor.
How do you do that?
Well, it's a vacuum, an extremely a precise vacuum distillation system.
So let me just explain one additional thing, is that vacuum distillation means that the product doesn't have to be pasteurized. It doesn't have to be heated up. Under certain methods for getting rid of alcohol, you heat the product up in a vacuum. The temperature doesn't have to be that high.
Temperature is about the temperature in this room, actually,
right,
at this moment.
So
you pull off the aroma flavor molecules, which are extremely light, and then keep those on one side, while at a higher temperature, you go in and distill off the amount of alcohol that you want to take off. Then you add back the aroma flavor. Now, I know it sounds terrible, and it did sound terrible.
It just sounds weird to me.
It sounded that way 28 years ago when we brought it in.
I'm sure.
But it became a standard winemaking tool. It's used by scores, if not hundreds, of winemakers now in many countries, because we also introduced it to Chile, South Africa, Spain. The reason it's not much talked about is that wineries obviously don't want it thought that their wine has been messed with in any way.
Of course.
Which is entirely understandable.
Sure.
So
I was involved in a ConeTech project some years ago with a winemaker who asked me to be an official taster for a test in which they showed the same exact wine. It was a Chardonnay that had 15.5 alcohol, and then there was another fraction of it that was about 14% alcohol, and then there was another fraction of it that was about, I think it was about 12.9 or something like that, and it was the same exact wine that had been treated with the spinning cone. And what I found were three completely different wines. It wasn't the same. I mean, the aroma changed, the taste changed, the texture changed, and it was the same wine. And I was blown away. And I preferred the lower alcohol wine.
Well, you always do.
always do.
So do I. I mean, are Chardonnay, are white wines involved in this, or is it just
it's both whites and reds.
Really?
Yes, yes, yes.
So I haven't run across too many
Well, I wish I could name names, but we are under
But you can't, yeah. Well, I haven't run into too many alcohol bomb Chardonnays or Sauvignon Blancs, but I guess that does exist.
They do have a tendency to reflect the vintage. And if a vintage is very hot and the winemaker didn't have an opportunity to get a crew fast enough and they had to let the grapes sit out there for three, 4, 5 days, then they're trapped. And this happens periodically in California. We don't have – I mean, not every vintage is 2010 and 2011. Those were cool years. Some of those vintages come along and it gets away. The winemaker does need – assistance. There are plenty of tools available to them. One of the most sophisticated is the spinning cone.
I've heard of the cone of silence. I haven't heard of the spinning cone. But how does this thing work? I mean, is it a big thing? Is it? I can't get my head around.
It's pretty big and pretty complex, actually. Yes, yeah. It's basically a still, if you can imagine that, with moving parts inside it. Which is mechanically pretty difficult to achieve, actually, and it's expensive, too. Each machine now costs about $1.5 million.
Jeez.
We own 10 of them in various different countries.
Wow.
Which gives you an idea of the extent to which its usage has become a standard winemaking tool.
Wow.
But the most significant thing about it today is that we're seeing an extraordinary sea change in the direction of non-alcoholic wines. And we're able to create a non-alcoholic product. It's not huge in the United States yet, but it is becoming very important in Europe. At a time when, of course, we're seeing consumer pushback against alcohol. There's a very strong global movement in the direction of moderation, thank God. It's all very well to talk about wine with no alcohol, but the key question is, what does it taste like? If it tastes horrible, nobody's going to want to drink it anyway.
Yeah, I've had...
No matter how healthy it is.
I've had a couple over the years where I've tasted the non-alcoholic wine, and I spit it out.
Well, if there's no flavor...
And it's
not easy to retain that flavor. It's very difficult because it's a fraction. I mean, think about this. You have a 15% alcohol wine... 85% of that is water. Where's the flavor component? It's really small. It's a tiny, tiny fraction.
Yes, yes. You can actually contain in less than 1% of the total volume of the wine all the volatiles that constitute aroma and flavor. I know it sounds almost sinister, but it's an entirely mechanical process. There's nothing chemical about it.
Right.
And there's nothing added back to the wine. It's purely a moment of judicious, a matter of judicious separation. If you will.
There's a winemaker in Australia who I've known over the years who's been working on a project to create a 7% alcohol table wine that has lots of flavor. And so I asked him, this is about 10 years ago when I was down in Australia talking with him, and I asked him why he was working on this project. And he said in all confidence at that time, now it's public, that he has been contracted by some companies in the Far East. Which countries, I'm not entirely sure. Probably, I would think, China and Japan, but who knows? Could be the Philippines. And I asked him why, and he said, one of the problems with certain ethnic groups is that they do not produce alcohol dehydrogenase naturally in their system the way white people do. In other words, people of certain color types are more susceptible to alcohol than others.
Hmm.
And it's those people who want to have a lower alcohol, full-flavored wine that they can enjoy on a regular basis without getting drunk without control. And the only way to do that right now with traditional table wine is to pour water into it. Well, that kills the flavor.
Yeah.
So that's what Kontek has pioneered here. Is very inventive. There are certain other techniques that have been used, but they don't work as well.
That's a fact.
You also do craft beer, huh?
Beer is relatively new to us because beer represents a whole new set of problems. Beer, you'd think beer was less complicated because it's got less alcohol in it. Actually, it's a lot more complicated because it's incredibly susceptible to oxygen. So the way you handle it is infinitely more difficult than wine. And it's taken us a long time, actually, to get to the root cause of the problems in order to be able to solve them. But we are now in a position to make a craft beer with greatly reduced alcohol or no alcohol at all that actually tastes like craft beer. And that's never been done before.
So does this mean, like, let's say some local craft brewery makes 10% alcohol, which is high? Do you take that and scale it down?
Well, to some degree, the beer has to be made in a way that renders it in perfect balance when the alcohol has been removed. Because you have to remember that with beer or wine, beer is a very important part of the structure of the product. And other things in the wine, like the tannins and the acids, begin to be obnoxiously conspicuous if you take the alcohol away, because alcohol is perceived on the palate as sugar, and that balances the acids and helps balance the tannins and so on. Subtract it, and all the other things fall out of whack. So basically, you need to make the wine in the first place to a fairly low acid and low tannin style in order to end up with the right balance at the end.
One of the key points that I raised in a column about 5 years ago was that wines that have 15 or 16% alcohol are produced as a result of consumer demand for more intensity of flavor, which actually is counterintuitive based on the way wine is made that way. If you make a wine with 15% alcohol, you're actually delivering less flavor than if it had 12%, if the same one had 12. The reason is that alcohol all by itself has a flavor, and that flavor is alcohol. That's the flavor of alcohol. And what that does is it interferes.
You heard it first right here.
Yeah, it was right. Exactly. Novel approach here. But when you have a wine that has been carefully had the alcohol reduced, you're actually accessing more flavor. We determined this just – my wife and I just had a bottle of wine the other day. Somebody sent me a bottle of wine that had 15% alcohol. So we tasted it and liked it. It was very nice wine, beautiful wine. But after about one glass of it, I noticed how much weight it was carrying on the palate. It was really heavy. It was somewhat clumsy. So I poured about a tablespoon of water into each of our glasses, and we sat back and smelled it, and the aroma hadn't changed at all. It was still the same exact thing. But what we were getting on the tongue was more flavor because the fact that the alcohol had gone from probably 15 to about 14 or maybe even lower. Just a tablespoon of water in a 5-ounce glass was an enormous benefit to us. Now, that doesn't mean to say we were making more wine. It ends up where you do eventually lose something in the aftertaste because the water is not helpful to the finish. It doesn't help the finish of the wine.
Yeah, I could see that.
But with what Tony's been doing, is a winemaker. Now, explain the process a little bit, Tony, because it's a little. It's not. You don't take all of your wine and give it to the spinning cone and have it reduce. It's a process.
No, that's one of the big benefits of it. We typically, if you're going to adjust to wine base by say 1.5% downwards from alcohol bomb level of 15.5 to say 13.9. You take only about 10% of the wine and take it down to close to zero and then blend it back. So you're only actually handling, processing, pumping a small quantity of the wine, whereas alternative methods like reverse osmosis, for example, which doesn't do a bad job, has to process the entire quantity of the wine and basically reduce it to a concentrate to which you then add back a vast quantity of water. We do none of that. We take a small quantity.
Just a point of reference here, but we're approximately 6 months from the 100th anniversary of the start of Prohibition. And
yeah, I remember that. Well, I was there.
You look pretty good for your age.
Yeah, thank you.
But as we go through this most recent, I would call it, wave of interest in more Prohibitionism, we start to see people all over the country saying, well, why didn't it work? Well, it didn't work. Just leave it at that. But the fact is that most people really don't. Millennial buyers really don't need to have the alcohol, and they aren't asking for it. When you hear that the millennials are asking for things like Gruner Veltliner, they're not asking for high alcohol wines. They're asking for balanced wine. So the new generation, the younger people who are buying wine today, are looking for structure more than they are intensity. And that intensity of alcohol actually does cover flavor. So what the spinning cone does is it provides an opportunity for winemakers to actually deliver more varietal characteristics to their wines.
Oh. By the way, the spinning cone performing at Hop Monk this Saturday. Inside joke. I can't help myself. You know that. Well, look at this. Cone Tech, California head office on Airport Boulevard. They're also in Spain, South Africa, Chile. Holy moly.
We'll be opening up this year in Australia and in France and in New Zealand.
Are they going to like it in France? Or are they going to...
you can imagine what a task it has been in France to get people even to talk to you. But that is changing dramatically. At the end of the day, the French are pragmatic. They want to sell their wine.
Yeah.
And if the world wants something that is less alcoholic, more moderate, or has no alcohol at all, then if you want to cater to that market, then you better do something about it.
Could you do this? This is maybe a dumb question. Can you do the same process with spirits?
Funnily enough, yes.
Wow.
Quite recently. And this has taken me by surprise. I would never have expected it. But there is demand on the part of several major producers in the whole concept of a spirit that's got all the character of the original, but instead of being diluted, has had alcohol subtracted to the point where it's an altogether softer drink.
Wow.
That's a whole new world, and it's not being done commercially yet.
And I can tell you,
it's over the hill.
Yeah, it's important that this be investigated fully, because there is a market out there for a lower alcohol spirit. Julianne and I have a friend who lives down in Southern California who I would consider to be an expert in the martini, and homegrown, knowledgeable. And we used to buy him gin every single time we visited. And we visited him at least 20 or 30 times over the several years. And we brought him a bottle of gin every time we went. And at one point, there was a very popular gin that was being used in San Francisco for making martinis. And it was very, very, very popular. And it was also very expensive. So we bought a bottle of it and brought it to him. And we said, try this. And he looked at the label, and it had really high alcohol. It was very high in alcohol for some reason. And I won't name the brand, but it was very popular a few years ago. We called him on the phone about a week or two later, and I said, so how did the martini come out? He says, that was the worst martini I've ever tasted in my life. And I said, why? He said, the alcohol got in the way of all the flavor.
Mm.
He said, I couldn't solve that problem with water, because every time I added the water, I lost the flavor of my gin. But he said, if they could reduce the alcohol on this gin, I'd make a great martini from it.
So interesting.
It was something that you have to work on, Tony.
Well, there's a whole new world of opportunity because of this increasing consumer consciousness of the whole issue of alcohol. There was a time, 15 years ago, when if you asked the average consumer how much alcohol does a bottle of wine contain, they wouldn't have a clue. But there's much more awareness now, much more desire to know, hey, what's in this bottle? That is changing consumer attitudes. And, of course, at the same time, you've got this pushback against alcohol of any kind, but nonetheless a desire for a sophisticated beverage that tastes good and is rather more palatable and more sophisticated than, say, a Diet Coke or something, with apologies.
50 years ago in France, chaptalization was popular, and that was the adding of sugar to fermentation to increase the alcohol. One of the reasons that French wines were so variable in those days was the fact that they didn't have enough alcohol, because it was cold, rainy weather throughout the entire growing season. Well, with global warming coming along, Tony's technology is going to be far more important. Think about this. The average temperature in California over the last several years has risen between 2 and 3 degrees on average. This is going to make for alcoholic wines because the higher sugars are going to be natural on the vine. The natural flavors won't develop until the sugars are much higher. So the spinning cone has a huge future in California in this area.
Yeah, they say that in 50 years' time, the world's best Cabernet will come from Sweden.
It is California wine country. We have a podcast available where every great podcast is offered. You can go to calwinecountry.com.
And subscribe.
And subscribe. Exactly. Our guest today is Tony Dunn, president of Cone Tech in Santa Rosa, conetech.com. Their California head office is on Airport Boulevard here in Santa Rosa. They're also in Spain, South Africa, Chile, and coming soon to Australia and France. Quickly explain what it is that Cone Tech's all about for folks just joining us.
Well, Cone Tech traditionally has been all about giving the winemaker an additional tool in his toolbox with which to control something he did not have complete control over before, and that was the level of alcohol in his wine from one year to the next. And traditionally, our business has consisted 95% of simply tweaking the alcohol and bringing it down, let's say, from some 15% to 13.5%, at which point the wine is very much more balanced most of the time and much more palatable. You don't have the hotness on the palate that masks aroma flavor, and we do this actually without any loss whatever of aroma or flavor in the wine.
How long ago, I think you mentioned this at the beginning, but how long ago did Cone Tech start?
28 years ago.
Wow.
I brought the first of these extraordinary machines from Australia to California, and winemakers looked at it and said, you've got to be crazy if you think anybody would want to put their wine through that thing. And over the next few years, it became a pretty standard winemaking tool that not widely talked about for pretty obvious reasons.
But 28 years ago, alcohol was not as much of an issue. Today, with global climate change and all the changes in how wine is being produced, today alcohol is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main problem, more than any other, is that the consumer will accept whatever's there. Now, you have an additional problem is that the tax changes starting about 18 months ago meant that wineries don't have to limit themselves to 14% to pay the lower federal tax. The higher federal tax starts now at 16%, not 14%.
And so, then you've got a true alcohol bomb at that level.
Yeah, now you've got 16% alcohol. You still have a table wine? I mean, don't light a match near that one. Well, let me go one additional step further with this business of the generation that is changing the way wine is being made and pursued. For the last, I would say, roughly 30 years, we've had a lot of people putting scores on wine. And if you look at it very, very closely, which I have, you'll find that the highest scores seem to line up with the highest alcohols. Hmm. Now, I don't know whether that's a result of anything that the reviewers wanted, unless it is simply the fact that the weight and the concentration of alcohol means that the wines taste slightly sweeter on the tongue. If you don't adjust that wine's acidity, then the alcohol will come across as sweetness. If you want sweet Cabernet, if you want sweet Chardonnay, if you want sweet anything that's supposed to be dry, you can have it. But I think that's changing. The latest generation that we've come in contact with, the millennials and maybe even Gen Z, which is even probably too young to drink, these are people who are interested in distinctiveness. They don't necessarily want weight. They want flavors that are interesting.
And except for the kids in college. They
well,
want
I
as much
alcohol
as they
can. Yeah, whatever you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
But I think that what Tony's been doing here, probably unknown to Tony 28 years ago, was to try to structure a wine or help winemakers structure a wine so that there's more compatibility with food. Some of the 100-point wines that I've tasted, and I've tasted plenty of these 100-point wines, They don't work with food at all. They're basically cocktail wines. Mm. To me, cocktail wines are fun, but not for a glass. For about two sips, and then you're finished. So is that the charge of some of your clients, Tony?
Well, yes, traditionally it most certainly has been. Most recently, believe it or not, there has been a demand for what we call lifestyle wines, wines with around 8 or 9% alcohol. There's one particularly successful brand called Sense, C-E-N-S-E, which is strongly supported by Weight Watchers, funnily enough, because with less alcohol, it's obviously got a lot less calories. And Sense has been a major market success. It's to be relaunched in a slightly different format and with a greater choice of varietals. But that's kind of paving the way for that category, which is very separate from the zero alcohol category, which is what an amazing number of millennials now want, in that it's got no alcohol at all.
Really?
But it's got a perceived level of sophistication to it.
There's also one additional development out of Australia, out of New Zealand. Julianne and I were in New Zealand in February, and we tasted a wine at Brancott, which is the largest wine company in New Zealand. Actually, the name of the company is Montana, but they changed the name for the U.S. market to Brancott. And Brancott is marketing around the world, including here, a low-alcohol Sauvignon Blanc that's called Flight Song, or is called Flight Song up until a few weeks ago, and then they changed the name to just simply Flight. Flight is a 7% alcohol Sauvignon Blanc that tastes exactly, to me, like their regular bottling, which is 12% alcohol. And I don't see any difference at all in the flavor profile or the structure. Now, I don't know. Tony, do you know anything about that wine?
No, I can't say I do, because we've not been operating in New Zealand until next month, when for the first time we will have equipment in place and we've entered into partnership with a major New Zealand producer.
What about non-alcoholic wines and food? Is that a thing? Can you, or does it not pair as well?
Some might say it doesn't, because they regard the alcohol as a sort of necessary accompaniment to food. But if you want something that is extremely pleasant to drink, absolutely doesn't compete with the food in any way. Yes, there's a major demand segment for that.
One thing that could be done, and I've talked to various winemakers about this, is that if you add more sugar or keep more sugar in the wine, but balance it with plenty of acidity, keep the acid really high, so you balance the wine based on its sugar and acid, then the non-alcoholic nature of the product is not as noticeable. And I've tasted a couple of test examples of this, and they're very interesting. They're very tasty. They don't remind you of wine, but they taste similar to a dry beverage. So it's a good idea to test this out with, for example, if you bought any of those bottles of Free, F-R-E, that are being made by Trinchero.
Yeah, and I've seen those before.
And they're reputable. They're really not like wine. But if you chill them down, including the reds, and just serve them cool enough so that you can actually make the impression of acid from the temperature, those wines are actually very reputable, and the sparkling is delicious. The sparkling Free is one of my favorite wines in the business these days, and it has no alcohol at all.
Wow.
Zero.
Amazing. It is California Wine Country, calwinecountry.com for your podcasts. All the shows are put up there. And it is brought to you by Bottle Barn. Dan Berger, of course, my co-host. And thanks to Tony Dunn, president of Contact.
Actually, Tony Dan, not that it matters that much.
Well, Tony Dan.
Yes, right. Yes. But don't worry about that.
Well, there's
much more important to remember Contech than me.
I've been saying done all hour. I mean,
no, that's okay. I pondered whether to correct it or not.
Oh, they do that all the time to me. So
not to worry.
Not to worry. Anyway, great to meet you, Tony Dan. It is Contech.com. They're in Santa Rosa and all over the world. It's a fascinating thing that you should go to the website and check out. It's fascinating. I said it twice. I'll say it again. It's fascinating. Tony, good to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
All right, kids, we'll see you next week. Do we know what we're doing next week?
Next week,
is it a Seminole thing?
No,
that's later.
Oh, Santa Rosa Junior College is having an event, and Kevin C., the instructor and coordinator for the program, is coming with gold medal wines made at the junior college.
Yeah, they're doing a good job.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, kids, thanks so much. We'll see you next week.